Yes, sorry I'm still here, but Pat and Cindy are gone, so I'm going to share this morning. And next week, because I couldn't get it all in. What I'm hoping to do, though, is this not really do a teaching, because like you guys are all really knowledgeable already, but I want to share some things I think that I've learned in my discussions with ongoing discussions with some atheist friends. Am I supposed to make some kind of announcement? Oh, Linda's here with her computer. If anybody wants to sign up for Perspectives today, you can do that if you catch Linda afterwards. So I'm sitting over here because those are my notes up there, and so I need to see the screen. So, what I hope to do is to share. I'm going to try to get through this in a half hour, and I'd love to have some discussion or a question time at the end, and maybe if you want to add anything on or take issue with anything. If you're new here, I'm not one of the pastors. Excuse me. So that means I get to say anything I want with no accountability. Not really. No, actually. So I want to talk about biblical faith versus faith because just in the course of having conversations with friends, and I've been doing this for a number of years now, there's an idea out there, both in the secular world and even in the church. I think they got it from the church. I think the atheists that I'm speaking to kind of originally got it from the church. But it's this idea of what faith is. And so I want to share what I feel like I've learned as a result of just sort of studying this out and searching this out. I haven't read a lot of books. I've just mostly gone to the Bible on the topic. So, I'm going to set my timer because punctuality is not the brightest light in my constellation of character qualities. So, I was trying to be polite to myself. So I'm going to set the timer for 30 minutes. If that goes off in the middle of what I'm saying, sorry. But that's... let me start out with a quote by Richard Dawkins. I'm going to read this stuff if that's too small. That's okay. So Richard Dawkins is sort of one of the, I guess you would say, leaders of the New Atheist movement. And there's this phenomenon called New Atheism, which I think what's really new about it, there's not really any new arguments or information around atheism. They still can't prove that God doesn't exist. But what's new is they're very almost proselytizing. And whereas before, I think it was almost like the first wave was more like, we deserve a place at the table too. And now the new atheist, I've read a couple of their books. They're actively saying people of faith should not have a place at the table. It's like if you hold to a sacred writings that were written by ignorant Bronze Age people, that should not be respected today in the public square, certainly not in academia. And so there's this idea that faith is an impediment to progress, and that we're actually dangerous because of our faith, because we hold faith and we consider that to be a legitimate thing. So here's how Richard Dawkins, he's a British atheist, he says, this is speaking at a science festival, he says, faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Okay, and then I'm just kind of setting up this situation. I put the little poison symbol up there just to show that I don't agree with these statements in case somebody walks in late, goes, oh yeah. But anyway, so here's Sam Harris, voted sexiest atheist of the year by Rolling Stone a couple years ago. Faith is the mortar that fills the cracks in the evidence and gaps in logic. and thus it is faith that keeps the whole terrible edifice of religious certainty still looming dangerously over our world. And I actually like Sam Harris. I enjoy reading him. He's really smart guy, way smarter than I am. He's a neuroscientist or something, and Richard Dawkins is some kind of biologist or something. But so he's written this book called The End of Faith, which I own and have read, and I actually agree with a lot of what he says in there. His critique of radical Islam is kind of spot on, and he does kind of have this very colorful language that he uses. But it's like the dude, for being a neuroscientist and way smarter than probably anyone in this room, maybe not, no offense, but he can't read the Bible and tell how faith is described in the Bible for whatever reason. And I think part of the reason is because the church has historically defined faith this way, belief without evidence. That's kind of in a nutshell how they define faith. So here's have you ever seen something like this? If we could prove God exists, then there would be no need for faith. I think I've kind of heard that all my life. I grew up in the church. I grew up in a Baptist church. We believe the Bible, and there's this notion that, like if a kid asks a question and the adults don't know the answer, nobody would bat an eye if the adult said, well, you know, we're not supposed to question. That's what faith is for. You've heard this, right? And nobody, that no one would really take issue with that idea. I'm just going to read one more from the church. So I just happened to run into this a couple weeks ago, and this is a quote by a guy named Don Batten. He's a creationist, and he's just sharing about an experience he had at a conference. He said, I had been invited to speak to a conference of librarians from what I thought were Christian schools. It transpired that the schools were independent private schools, and many were not strongly Christian. Excuse me. Gosh, I don't know what's going on there. I spoke about the real events of creation, the fall, and the flood, showing how they related to the gospel. I provided evidence for divine design in living things and examples from geology and geography of evidence for the global flood of Noah. And I could see a man leaning back in his chair, arms folded, looking quite puzzled as I spoke. At the end, in the Q&A, he asked, what has evidence got to do with faith? This man came from a church tradition that saw faith as a work that earned merit with God. He seemed offended by the notion that faith could relate to real-world evidence. To him, faith was believing despite the evidence, which is exactly how Richard Dawkins defined faith. And the more difficult it was to believe, the more merit in the faith. With me providing evidence, it actually diminished his faith. So supposedly there's this idea that faith is believing in things that have no evidential support. So I just want to run through this briefly and try to make the case that is not biblical faith. And I would say, I think this definition of faith, belief without evidence, is probably true for a lot of religions, maybe most religions. It's just not biblical faith. So from here on out, I'm going to talk about, when I talk about faith, I'm talking about biblical faith, the way the Bible talks about faith. But for sure, like I've got a Mormon friend I invited to a conference, a creationist conference one time, and he said, he emailed me back, said, thanks, we're not really into proving things. It's like, okay, and it was enlightening, but I just thought it might be interesting for him to hear, you know, another perspective. But I would say, I would argue it's probably true of Islam as well, but I don't know enough about, you know, all the religions of the world to say whether or not that's true. But I don't think that's the way the Bible describes faith, and I'll show you why. And if I say something here that sort of tweaks you and is like, dude, I'm not sure that's right. Jot it down and let, you know, we can talk about it afterwards if you want to. So that first phrase, to persuade, to have confidence, that's just the literal Greek the literal Greek meaning of the word that's translated faith the vast majority of the time throughout the entire New Testament. It just means to have confidence in. That doesn't really help us answer the question, though, today, because you can have confidence with or without evidence. But I just wanted to put it up there so that, in case you're wondering, what does the word actually mean? That's what it means. But I would contend that biblical faith has to do with confidence or belief in the person of God, and in what he has said he will do, you know, his promises. And so when we talk about faith, we're talking about belief in a person, trust in a person. And I would say two big things, big ideas that I see is biblical faith is relational and it's evidential. And I think that sets biblical faith apart from the other ideas of faith that are out there floating around in the floatosphere. I just made that word up. Today, we're only going to talk about number two. The relational one is actually the more fun one to talk about in a way, and we're going to talk about that next week, and there's going to be lots of biblically goodness as we walk through, you know, the big faith verses in the Bible, and sort of map over how it's relational, how is it relational, and just to kind of see what that point is really about. But today we're going to talk about evidential, very briefly. By the way, I just want to be really clear. I don't hate these people, the atheists. I consider them friends. I love talking to them, and I learn a lot from them, and their perspective helps me to know my perspective better. And I just want to make sure there's no, don't read any animosity or, you know, anger or, you know, whatever against with these people, because they need Jesus like everyone else. And so that's why I talk to them. I'm going to blow through this really quick because we might revisit this again next week. It's helpful for me in understanding what something is sometimes to understand what it's not. And so these are kind of ideas that are out there. Faith is wishful thinking. Some people kind of use that interchangeably. If I just believe hard enough, well, if God hasn't promised that's going to happen to you, you know, I don't think that's going to get you a result. An irrational form of positive thinking. A formula, that's a big one for me. My natural tendency is to look for formulas, look for principles that I just need to know the principles and plug them in to get the desired result. Faith is it's a relational thing, and it's a trust in a person, not a formula. In the same way I don't approach my wife according to a formula, I try not to approach God that way. A mystical religious force that we can appropriate, like the Star Wars movies. It's something that's out there and we can, like, you know, pull it in and use it. It's not an abstract attribute like courage or charisma. Like a thing, oh, you know, David has faith. Like, how'd you get that? It's a thing we do. It's a response to a person. And we're going to focus mostly on this one. Anti-intellectual faith is not, biblical faith is not anti-intellectual or anti-science. In fact, science, modern science, what we know as science today, arose one time in history around all the cultures of the world, and arose in Christian Europe. It was because of a conception of God that we have. Yes, technology existed, existed all over the place in several cultures, but this thing called science, where we systematically learn about the world and test and categorize, arose in Europe, Christian Europe, because of a biblical worldview. And now it's no longer, you know, attached to a biblical worldview necessarily, but there certainly is no conflict. Anyway, how am I doing? Okay. Biblical faith is evidential. That's what we're going to talk about today briefly. Evidential both textually and scientifically. So this is kind of about demonstrating that biblical faith is textually evidential. The first one is, the first verse up there is an Old Testament verse. The second one is a New Testament verse. If we could just read that first verse together, if you can see it, let's just read this together as a proclamation. I will remember the deeds of Yahweh. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What a God is great like our God. Psalm 77. Thank you. You read that better than I did. So just to say, I could have picked a ton of different verses in the Old Testament to put up there as an example, because there's all kinds of verses like this where God is commanding people to look back at things he's done in history and space and time and history. And or David, King David is celebrating what God's done. Remember your deeds of old. I remember your wonders of old. God has established feasts specifically to help people to remember things, amazing, miraculous, supernatural things he did in history, in real space and time in history, like the Passover is a big one. The Jewish people have been celebrating that for 400 years to remember this event that really happened according to the Bible. And even the idea of covenants, even the idea that God makes covenants with human beings, and I will do this, and if you'll do this, and or even if you don't do this, I'll do this, you know. And the idea of him making agreements with human beings and then marking that with a sign or some sort of feast or I guess we could say ritual in the Old Testament. The Bible describes faith as a thing that's rooted in things God has done. God has gone out of his way to show himself worthy of trust. I don't think I see God ever going, believe me, just because I say so. And I hope that doesn't sound heretical, but he does things. He has done things to prove himself. It only makes sense because he's invisible. So we don't know him. He demonstrates his love. He demonstrates his character. He demonstrates his trustworthiness by doing things in history, in our world, and asking us to remember. And so the second verse is from 2 Peter. So if we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty, we ourselves heard, for we were with him, and we have something more sure, the prophetic word. So this alone is a textual testimony to what God has done, and it refers back to earlier testimony, the prophetic word. God has said things hundreds of years before they happen, so that when they happen, we could go, that's the fulfillment. God keeps his promises. Okay, so he's building reasons for us to trust him. 1 John 1:1, again, there are a bunch of verses we could put up there, but 1 John 1:1 is that which we have heard from the beginning, that which we've seen, which we've heard, which we touched with our hands. In the beginning of Luke, the first four or five chapters, or excuse me, verses of Luke, before he introduces the gospel with, you know, many have made an account of the things that have happened, so I wanted to do one too and tell you the things, so you would know, you know, what occurred and how these things happened. So the Bible is not written like folklore, where, you know, the maiden turns into a swan and flies away. It's full of genealogies and dates and times, and this person was king when this happened, and it's designed so we can, like, know and have some sort of confidence in what it said. And maybe I'm beating the point, but you can't say. So when I talk to my atheist friends, they'll try to say, you know, there's no evidence for God. I was like, I say, well, you know, you might not agree with these guys. You might think they got the story wrong. You might not believe Jesus existed. You might think it's all made up, but you can't say the Bible doesn't appeal to evidence, because it does, all throughout the whole thing. Now we can talk about whether it's true, but that's, the Bible is written this way. So then, on as far as scientific evidence goes, a lot of new guys will come in to the group and with guns blazing, and they almost always start out with, of course, it's almost like an assumption. It is an assumption. There's no evidence for God. There is no scientific evidence for God. And I'll say, actually, there's a ton of evidence for God. And I'll say, well, there's nothing verifiable and scientific. And I'll say, actually, there's a lot. I'm like, well, even if that were true, you can't, there's no evidence for the biblical God. Like, how do you know which God it is? And it could be the Hindu God. And it's like, no, actually, there's a ton of evidence for the biblical God. And then we go into it. But and I asked them the question. It's like, you tell me, okay, so I agree with you that we can't put, you know, God, the Spirit, under a microscope and examine him because he's not physical. But the Bible makes these claims that God has acted in history. And in some cases, he's acted in such a big way, in a consequential way, that he's left a trace behind that we can now physically, scientifically, verifiably look at some of these things. And that's not true of everything. Like, we can't prove that Jesus walked on water because he did that, and then they left no artifact. There's nothing observable there to look at. But there are certain events where God has, there's a sort of this intersection between the spiritual and the physical, and we can see it. And it's pretty cool. And let me just say one quick thing about evidence. When I say evidence, I'm not saying, you know, we can prove 100% that God exists, because nobody gets the luxury of 100% certainty on either side of the debate. But we can certainly say there's evidence. There is physical evidence in the world that corresponds with the biblical story, and there is nothing that rules it out. I would even argue that the same is not true for microbes to man evolution, although this is not going to be a talk about creationism and evolution. But anyway, let me run through these. The creation is the obvious one. That's obviously a supernatural event, obvious to us anyway. And I'll talk maybe a little bit more about that on the very last slide, which is coming up next. A global flood. Probably most people in the room are kind of generally familiar with the idea that if there was a global flood, such as what was described in the Bible, this violent upheaval, turbulent global flood, what we see in the world, what we see in geology, is consistent with what you would expect to see, namely a whole bunch of millions of dead things buried quickly in layers of sediment all around the world, even on our highest mountain ranges. So a descent from the human race, from Noah's sons, I'm not going to take time to go into that, and it's way outside my wheelhouse anyway, but apparently, according to a couple of geneticists I've heard speaking on the subject, there's that sentence in the Bible that says it talks about the sons of Noah, and it says from these all the families of the earth came from these Noah and his sons. Well, apparently that's like a big mistake if, you know, the Bronze Age Bible writers were just like making this stuff up, because it turns out that's a genetically testable statement, and if that were false, we've mapped the human genome now, we'd be able to tell if there were a whole bunch of different Y chromosomes out there. There's basically one line. And that's passed down from the father. It's not true of the mitochondrial lines. It's true of the Y, the male, the lines passed down through the male. But anyway, that's kind of cool, I think, because the genetics is like the newest, you know, field, scientific field, and they're still learning a ton. And the guy that I heard speaking on this, he was like, could all change, you know, but because things change all the time in science. But as of today, what we know from genetics is very friendly to the biblical story, not just in this case, but some others. So the Hebrew Exodus, that had to be a supernatural event. You got over a million people enslaved by the most powerful nation empire in the world at the time, and somehow they freed themselves, enriched themselves, basically plundered the Egyptians and defeated the Egyptian army. And it's certainly described as a supernatural event in history. And God, I think God really likes that one because he constantly refers back to it. And that's what the Passover feast is all about, remembering this. He's even inserted a foreshadowing of Jesus, what was to come in the Passover lamb and all that stuff. Anyway, he refers to the Passover a lot. And so it's very important in biblical chronology and biblical and a biblical worldview. The problem is, I heard this all my life. Went to the secular art school, and all my life I've heard Egyptologists, secular Egyptologists, saying there is absolutely no evidence that this occurred. It's a nice story. There's just no evidence that it happened. And so I just want to hold this video up. I just found out about this a couple years ago. Patterns of evidence. Some guy went and kind of researched this out, and we kind of showed this in our small group one night, part of it. I asked Pat if we could, the church could just buy a bunch of those. I wanted to send them to these atheist guys I'm talking with online. But we have some. I've got some here if anybody wants to, if you're interested in this kind of thing. And, you know, for me, it really builds my faith to go, wow, there's a lot of evidence here. It's really not true to say there's no evidence. And in a nutshell, I'll just tell you this. The reason they say there's no evidence is because they've sort of identified this one pharaoh that they think, you know, the Exodus would have happened under this pharaoh, and there's no evidence there. And this guy's case is, it's because the Exodus occurred like several hundred years before that. They got the wrong pharaoh, and he builds his case for that. And so, of course, they're looking here. It's like, there's absolutely no evidence. It's because, yeah, because they're all gone. But anyway, I've got a couple of these up here. If you want to come and check them out, I would like for you to return them to me, unless you're going to give them away to somebody, a non-believer person. And the last one, the Star of Bethlehem. How am I doing? If you want a source of evidence that can't be tampered with by human hands, think about the stars and planets. There's like the stars and planets move according to discoverable, plottable laws of motion. It's like a giant clock. And we have computer software now that can run the clock forward or run the clock backwards, so we can know exactly what the sky looks like or looked like at any point in history. That means we can go back to ancient Israel and know what the Magi were seeing from Bethlehem, or excuse me, from Jerusalem on their way to Bethlehem. Like, you can pick a point in the world and know what it looked like from, you know, Antarctica or, you know, Africa or whatever. So we can know what the Magi were seeing, and there's really good evidence that they were seeing. That's pretty amazing, and matched exactly what the Matthew talks about, even to the point of a star stopping over where the child was. Can a star do that? Well, it turns out it can. It can appear to do that from depending on where you are standing. So anyway, I've also got a video on that, but I think I must have lent it because it wasn't in my drawer. Does anybody have my video, The Star of Bethlehem? Do you? Danny has it. Thanks. I just do these things and I can't remember. I must have liked the person. Anyway. So I'm going to wrap it up here. I got one more slide. So those things, there's more than that, by the way. Those are just ones I think I can defend and talk to people about. So that's positive scientific evidence that exists for the God of the Bible and the things he's done in history. And then this is more negative evidence on the theory of evolution. I'm not sure I should really, maybe it's not appropriate to go into that. For one thing, I'm not qualified to speak on this. I'm not in a science field or even a STEM field. Let's just look at the first two though, because I do, I'll leave it up here if you want to read it. But I've been using these 4 points in my discussions lately, and I think there it makes sense. So I'm no longer trying to convince atheists that the Bible is true and that creationism is right. It's way too ambitious of a goal. I'm just trying to get them to see that their position is also a faith position, and that they also have dogma. They don't like to hear that, but it's just, there are things they cannot question because, like deep time, the billions and billions of years, they got to have the Earth be 4.5 billion years old, or evolution cannot have occurred. There's not enough time for it to have occurred. That's a dogmatic belief. It's not provable, but they hold it by faith. So the idea is that a materialist evolution claims that natural processes explain everything we see. There is no supernatural. Natural processes explain everything you see. But there is no known, as of today, there is no known observable natural process by which the material universe could have accidentally created itself. So we don't know how the whole thing began. And as of today, there is no known observable natural process by which non-living matter can generate living organisms. So these are faith positions. They have theories, they have ideas, they're working on it, but that's the answer. I was like, and I say, but that's not a scientific belief at this point, right? Because there's no natural process. Like, well, but someday science will figure it out. It's like, right, but that's a faith position, right? Because it's like, no, I don't like that word. But that's exactly what Dawkins, that's how they define faith, disbelief despite the evidence. So anyway, that's, I'm not going to go through the rest of that. The three and four is we don't know how life evolved and we don't know how life can still be here. But I'm about to get dinged here. So in fact, I'm going to shut this off because it will be annoying if it goes off. Cancel. So I guess to sum up, I would just want to say this stuff matters, especially in our culture right now that's extremely divided politically, racially, religiously. I think we need to confidently have a place at the table in the public square, and we need to confidently know that biblical faith is not anti-intellectual, it's not anti-science, it is not an impediment to progress, and learn to handle that. And for us personally, I think of the verse that says, I think it's Romans 5:8, for God demonstrates his love for us. God demonstrates his love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So he doesn't just tell us, doesn't just tell us in the Bible, I love you. He demonstrated it by becoming human flesh, dying on the cross. And the Bible points that out and underlines it. He shows us. He demonstrates his love for us. So we can have confidence in him. So that when circumstances suggest otherwise, we can still believe. We can still have confidence. We can still trust that he is who he is. He said he is. And he will do what he said he will do. So I'm not saying we can have all of our questions answered. I'm not saying we can know everything, obviously, but I'm saying because God has demonstrated himself textually, scientifically, in other ways, we can really have confidence in him. And it gives me confidence to see these things that we talked about. So that's all I got. And we've got a few minutes if you guys want to talk about this or maybe add a comment or take issue or have a question.
Isn't it true that the smartest guy in the world believes in not, believes that there's a supreme being, but he won't name it as God? What is that guy's name that has said there had to have been, shouldn't have talked because my brain's not working. There had to have been intelligent design. That was it. That he's out there saying there had to have been intelligent design. There's no way. I think it's Stephen Hawking. Yeah, that Sam.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good for him.
Yeah. So even like the most smartest guy in the world said, "Yeah, there's no way this is going to happen." But we can't call that intelligent design, God. Maybe it was aliens. I don't know.
Yeah, and I don't know how we determine who the smartest guy in the world. I thought it was David Jump or Jim Rosevear, but you know, Edgar, Dan. Now I've started naming names, so I have to say everyone ever. Sorry. Anyway, yeah, there are one of my favorite creationist guys is a geneticist. His name's John Sanford. He was an evolutionist for his entire career almost, and he actually is responsible for some things I really don't like. Like, he invented the gene gun, so a lot of genetically modified foods are probably, you know, a result of his research. But eventually he became a believer, just because the more he delved in, it's like, it's just, and then he became a young earth creationist after that, and he's written this book called Genetic Entropy. And actually the fourth point there comes from his book. It's not a very happy book, because it shows how the human genome is deteriorating at a measurable rate. And we cannot have been here for 100,000 or 200,000 years, is the length of time that evolutionists say modern human beings have been around. We're going to be... the depth of the salvation that God has wrought in us is way deep, and that's why we're going to have to get new bodies, because we're like toast genetically. We're going downhill, not uphill. But anyway, and it's even that is interesting, how this fanciful airy fairy stuff that we read in the Bible about, you know, resurrection and new bodies, it's like, it's kind of, if we're going to continue to be human, body, soul, and spirit, we're going to have to get new bodies, because this physical is not going to inherit the imperishable. But anyway, any other thoughts? Or yes,
it's Bradley Montan, I think, who you're talking about. Mom, there's an article there that doesn't sound.
Oh, okay.
It's also Stephen Hawking. Yes, yeah. Stephen Hawking, yeah, also admits intelligent design is highly probable.
That's good.
So I've never heard of that other guy. So.
Yeah, there's an atheist philosopher, Anthony Flew, that also has become a believer in God, if not a Christian. I'm not sure, but anyway, that's good. I say we pray for these guys, because they're influential. And by the way, also that I can't find any atheists who will admit that they actually like Sam Harris or Richard Dawkins. So it's not like an organized movement where they're like marching on Washington, you know, the atheist march on Washington. And they're still a minority in the population, but they're having an influence in the culture. Atheism is not a respectable viewpoint, especially in academia. But anyway, I will wrap it up. I hope this has been encouraging for you. I hope it wasn't too annoying or, you know, inward. Let me just close this with a prayer, and we can visit and leave. Father in heaven, we do thank you that you are good, and you have gone out of your way to prove yourself. Not that you needed to, not that you were obligated to, but you've given us reasons to trust you. You've shown yourself to be trustworthy. And God, we especially thank you for demonstrating your love to us through Jesus, but also his example, God. We just thank you that you've thought of everything, and you know what we need, and you've given it to us. And I pray that you will enable us. Some of us are dealing with really, really hard things right now. And I pray that even in the midst of that, those of us who are dealing with those things can maintain a strong trust, faith, belief, confidence in you, in who you are, and that you will accomplish the things that you've said. And thank you for the coming week, coming holiday, where we give thanks to you. We thank you that we have someone to give thanks to, God. And we just pray all these things in the name of Jesus. I pray that as we're with our families this week, or friends, even over the holiday, that you would just make us alert to divine appointments or conversations that you might have in mind for us to have with people. And just pray that you would use us as your instruments this week. Lead us into the good works that you have for us to walk in. In the name of Jesus, amen.